Take your Bibles tonight and turn with me to the book of 1 Samuel in the 14th chapter. One thing I do want to say, I really appreciate having special music in the evening service. That's been something that maybe it's come upon us so gradually that some of you haven't noticed, but I really like that. If nothing else, it really ministers to me and helps me get ready to preach. And I'm ready to preach tonight, so you're in trouble. 1 Samuel chapter 14. I'd like to stand together. We're just going to read three verses, and I'm going to preach on more, but we'll be reading chapter 14, verse 1 through verse 3, and I tried to give myself most of the tough names in here, okay? Let's stand, please, together to give honor to the public reading of the Word of God, 1 Samuel 14, verse 1 through verse 3. I'll read, and then you read verse 2, and then I'll do verse 3. Now it came to pass upon a day that Jonathan, the son of Saul, said unto the young man that bare his armor, Come, let us go over unto the Philistines' garrison that is on the other side. But he told not his father. But Ahiah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the Lord's priest in Shiloh, wearing an ephod. And the people knew not that Jonathan was gone. May the Lord add his blessing to the word, and you may be seated. One of the reasons why I had you read that together is I want to talk about some things in the end of chapter 13 and then chapter 14. But the situation is, you've got Jonathan and his armor bearer, Saul and his men, and you've got the Philistines at a place called Michmash. It's always helpful if you know a little bit about the way that Israel is laid out, and not many people know even a little bit about the way Israel is laid out. When you read the Bible, you're supposed to know that. It was written to people who would know what's the significance of this. I don't know how to describe, and I don't have any good way to point out what it would look like, Israel would look like to you. Suffice it to say that Saul had his capital in Gibeah. The Philistines were normally hanging around down on the plains, some 30 miles away. They almost never came up into the mountains. And Saul had his cheesy little capital in Gibeah. But they moved up to Michmash, which is 2.5 miles away. Now, Gibeah is a strategic road because on either side of it, I guess I will use, we'll use the cross as an illustration. If we put Jerusalem right in the center of the cross, okay, there is just about 4 inches above it would be Gibeah, and an inch above that would be Michmash. There are, running up through the mountains, one main road north and south. On either side, there are chasms, if you want to call them, very, very deep and steep valleys. And you, at Gibeah, there are two places along this road where it narrows down to about 100 yards where you can safely pass through without having to go up and down these real steep canyons. One of them's at Gibeah, and one of them's 2 miles up at Michmash. Saul had put his capital at Gibeah because it's right astride that main road. It's as far south as you can go in Benjamin before you hit the territory of Judah. And Saul was from the tribe of Benjamin, so he put his capital there. So it's as far south as he could go and still be in Benjamin, but he put it there to control that main trade road. Now the Philistines, who used to be all the way over there next to the sea, which would be basically behind the piano over there, they came up and they choked off the trade road to the north. 2.5 miles away. That's not something you can put up with. That's not something that you can just say, well, it's a threat. It's a dire threat. It's like somebody choking you at your neck. They're taking all your air away. And when you understand that, that's why it says in verse 14, that's why in chapter 13, in verse 23, it said, the garrison of the Philistines went out to the passage of Michmash. We'll talk about what makes Michmash even more strategic in a moment. Now it came to pass that Jonathan said, Let's go, to his armor bearer. But Saul tarried, at verse 2, in the uttermost part of Gibeah under a pomegranate tree, which is in Migron. My question is, why do some people go and some people stay? Why is it that in the Lord's work, some people get things done and some people don't? Some people get to the job and God uses them and they step forward and do something for the Lord, and some people don't. They never get around to doing it. What makes the difference between two sets of people? You know, most churches figure that about 20% of their membership does about 80% of the work. I'm glad it's not that way in our church. I don't want to pastor a church where that's true. But that's considered the norm, by the way, in regular Baptist churches, not in, you know, across the United States in our fellowship. That's considered the norm. You ask yourself, why is that? Why do some people get blessed and work and other people never get around to it? Well, I don't want to talk about why some people don't get around to it. With Saul, we're going to see that after Saul, and we're not going to see this, if I was preaching this series, you'd see it, that Saul had been appointed king, and his first test came where he had to deliver the people of Gibeon who were being oppressed. Saul stepped out and did something. The next time he stepped out was when foreign forces came in, and Saul was supposed to wait for Samuel, and Saul didn't do it. He did it on his own. And you know, after that, Saul never once goes and meets the enemy willingly. Every time after that, somebody else is doing it. He's sending David out to meet the Philistines. He's sending Jonathan out to do something. And the only other time that the Bible records where Saul takes the initiative is the time he dies. When he dies, he manages to kill his sons in the process. I think that what happened to Saul was when Samuel told him, I'm not going to support you anymore. From this day forth, Saul got terrified and timid, and he wouldn't act, and he wouldn't work, and the Philistines are choking him off, and he can't do anything about it. The question that I want to deal with tonight is, why did Jonathan? What made him do something about it? What is there, when you read about David in the Bible, one of the incredible things is we don't emphasize that the Bible talks so much about Jonathan and his exploits and what kind of warrior he was. You get this picture of David and Jonathan, if you've seen it, though I have in our Sunday school material, they're two wimpy little guys, you know, two little like 13-year-old boys hanging out there shooting arrows in the field, you know, or they were both tremendous warriors in a time when warriors were, you know, they were highly regarded. This is the age of the Homeric epics, of all the mighty Greek warriors, and we'll talk about the relationship the Philistines had to that. But these were some big guys. But how come Saul, who is the biggest and the tallest, remember? He was a head taller than everybody else. How come Saul isn't doing it and Jonathan is? Well, just want to give you a few things tonight. One, people who get the job done are self-motivated. They don't wait for someone to tell them what to do. Notice it says here, and the simple part is, came to pass upon a day that Jonathan said to his armor bearer, let's go. He didn't wait for his dad to send him. He didn't wait for the army to do anything. He said, let's go. The point I want to look at more deeply is, why him? Why did he do it? How come he acts? Why nobody else in Israel? What does self-motivation, is that a personality where some people are go-getters and some people aren't? A lot of Christians like to think that. That way, if they've got the non-go-getting personality, they don't ever have to go and get until somebody, they're gone and got them and made them do it. So their idea is, well, I'm just not that kind of person. Well, that's not what's behind motivation here. Step back with me earlier to verse 19 of 2 Samuel chapter 13, the previous chapter. I want you to see what motivation is here, why he does it. Now there was no smith found throughout all the land of Israel. There is their real problem. Okay? One good smith would have solved all those motivation problems, okay? For the Philistines said, lest the Hebrews make them swords or spears, but all the Israelites went down to the Philistines, made that trek from the mountains down to the plains, went down to the Philistines to sharpen every man his share, his coulter, his axe, and his mattock. And they had, this is a King James word. It has to do with all their farm implements. What's happening is we are at the turning point of an age in the world when we come to this biblical text. Just like the world changed through the industrial age, just like the world changed at different points, we're at a turning point. It's going from the Bronze Age into the Iron Age. They were up to this point, iron wasn't used, it had been discovered, but no one had really learned how to work with it. Iron, as far as transporting it, you don't find iron in Palestine. You've got to bring it all the way down from Turkey to find it. And working with iron requires a process, just like the next big step was when somebody found out how to make steel out of iron, which requires a baking process where you bake it in coals and coke, and you've got to put a certain element back into the iron to toughen it up. But before that, they had all fought with bronze. And now the world is changing, because the difference is, well, if you ever went out there with a bronze sword and the other guy had an iron sword, you'd rapidly find out just how quickly the world is changing. You know, you fight differently with a different weapon. For instance, it was not until the invention of steel that you could make the long, thin weapons, because iron is soft. You make a long, thin iron implement, you can't make a sword that's long and thin in iron, because it will bend. And then your sword is bent, you're standing there like that, and the other guy's laughing at you like, back up a minute. You know, it doesn't work that way. When you have implements out of bronze, because bronze chips so easily, the way they make them is they make them wide at the bottom and narrowing down to a point, just like a big spearhead. And so you don't use bronze this way, you use bronze this way. You don't hack somebody with bronze, you stab somebody with bronze, okay? So here's the stabbing motion, like this. And so all your tactics are based on trying to stab the guy. Ha, 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 ha. Now somebody goes out and invents iron, digs it up and invents it. Here's the problem. Iron now has the strength that you can make wide, flat, long weapons. I mean, long weapons, okay? So now you're going, ha, ha, ha. And he goes, whoosh. You're down a finger, you know, ha, ha, ha. Whoosh. You're down a hand. Now you're lefty fighting, you know? You can't get away from an iron weapon. Iron will shatter the bronze, it will shatter the bronze sword. Iron is heavy enough, much, much heavier than bronze in fighting. So when you fought, you don't want to go like this with iron, because if you've ever held something out there that's really heavy, even a baseball bat, it's really heavy, you can't do that. You want to swing the iron. The world changed. Fighting changed. There's only one problem. Nobody had the iron. Okay, the Philistines recognized and said, you know, we kind of got one up. We got the iron, they don't. We're not going to allow them to have any iron. And again, the mountains in Israel will not produce iron. They're not iron-bearing mountains, they're limestone. So you're not going to get iron out of there. The iron had to be brought down from Turkey, from a people called the Hittites. And so it was shipped down, and guess who controlled the shipping? The Philistines controlled the shipping. You don't want to carry iron by donkey back all the way down. That's not really the, you know, your donkey doesn't want you to do it, at least. And so you landed along the coast, and the Philistines had a monopoly, and they wouldn't let their enemies get any. Even to, in terms of sharpening, when you want to sharpen something, you have to use something harder than what you have to sharpen it. You know, you can't take two soft things and sharpen one another. So they were the ones who had the control, not only on the raw material, but on the technology. And you ever watch that show called Nova on TV? You realize that the technology involved in making weapons and making plowshares and these various things, the technology is absolutely incredible. And for instance, in Great Britain, there was a time when the use of iron plowshares absolutely went out of existence. Nobody used them. They used wooden plowshares, big, thick wooden plowshares, which... How well do you think they dig into the ground? Actually, it's one big stick that you stick in the ground. Somebody rides on it, and somebody beats your horse or whatever that pulls you along. And you can't get much ground plowed that way. It wasn't until about 1250 that iron was reintroduced in a special iron plowshare. You know, the kind that curves out now and pushes it nicely away? All of a sudden, you can use more than one horse and more than one team to pull your plowshare through. When you've got this one stick sticking in the ground, if you've got a big, heavy load of team in front of you, it's going to pull the stick right out of the ground. So that invention enabled the massive growth that took place in the 13th and 14th centuries in Europe, because now you can feed more people, so you can have more people. Well, these are the kinds of things that are happening here. The Iron Age are coming in. The number of people and in the population is growing rapidly. Warfare is growing rapidly, and it's changing. The Philistines are Greeks. They're specialists in warfare. We already saw a couple weeks ago that God used the Philistines to teach Israel how to fight. By the way, there are so many things that you can see in the Bible that are Philistine. An example, when you start getting to David, all of a sudden you start getting lists of David's mighty men. Have you ever noticed how many threes there are? Everything's by threes. These were the first three. These were the second three. These were the 30. Well, that's Greek. I don't know if you've ever read the Iliad or the Odyssey, but you'll see that there are the special terms that are used was the Greeks had a threefold. There were three leaders to three leaders to three leaders. Every group, whether we would call it a battalion, a division, didn't have one leader. It had three with their responsibilities. And it's kind of interesting how even when David later on goes out to fight Absalom, he divides his army up into three parts. His picked bodyguards, they're called the Pelethites, which is the form of the word that means Philistine. The TH and the SH are the same. And Cherethites, which is CRT. You know the nation of Crete? The island of Crete, which is where the Philistines came from. All this by way of saying, here was a people that were expert in warfare. Here was a people that had control of the arms. They had a monopoly on everything, and they're threatening Israel. Israel's about to become extinct, and nobody wants to do anything. One reason is because they don't have weapons. One reason is because Saul's sitting under a tree. How do you get motivated to act? Well, notice what it says. So, in verse 22 of chapter 13, it came to pass in the day of battle that there was neither sword nor spear, meaning iron sword or iron spear, found in the hand of any of the people that were with Saul and Jonathan, but with Saul and with Jonathan there was. You know why Jonathan acted? Why he was motivated to act? Because he realized that God had equipped him to act. He's one of the two people in Israel who's got iron weapons. By the way, it's not just his sword that's iron, it's his shield and his armor as well. You kind of like to have both of them. You know, in the NFL, you need a good offense and a good defense. He had both of them. And motivation isn't this, oh, I want to do it and I want to do it and I want to get things done, because there's a lot of people with a lot of energy who don't get things done. Motivation is when you come to realize God gave me the equipment because he wants me to do the job. There were two people God equipped to do the job. One was Saul and one was Jonathan. And Jonathan waited until he found out that Saul wouldn't do it, and he did. And when it comes in a church to doing something and to getting things done, I don't think it's the go-getters who really all the time help the church. That there's a special group of personality, hippity-hoppity people who you get enough of those and things get done. Because I found sometimes the hippity-hoppity people do a hippity-hoppity job when it comes time to getting some real progress. It's the people who say, you know, I can help. I can do that. I'm willing to do that. God gave me the equipment to do that. God gave me the funds to support the church. I can help with this. I'm willing to help with that. Yeah, I can handle that. That's what motivation is. When you realize, hey, God put me here for a reason. God allowed me this. God gave me that. I'll give you an example. Mrs. Crispell. You know what God gave her for her ministry? A van. That's her ministry. Am I correct in understanding that was her mom-in-law's ministry too? Is it Rachel's mother-in-law, right? That was her ministry. And she said that. She says, well, I'll tell you, if you've got a need, whenever you've got it, I've got the van. That's why God gave me the van. You know, that's the approach that a person takes. That's what motivation is. If you know Rachel, she's not the kind who's going to step forward and do a lot of other things, but that's what God gave her the equipment to do, and that's what she's doing. And that's what the same thing Jonathan did. He was the one with the armor, so who has to do it? It's the people who God equips. And you say, God gave me the equipment, so I should do it. It's interesting, he gets his armor bearer. Now we're going to talk about this armor bearer. This is great. This guy never has a choice in the whole matter. And what's interesting to me is that there are some people who are self-motivated in the sense, like Jonathan saying, God gave me the equipment, I'll do it. And there are some people who God gave the duty just to follow them. And I'll help. I'll carry the shield. You know, not all of us are Jonathans, but the rest of us ought to be the armor bearer. So this armor bearer, it's kind of interesting what happens here. Jonathan goes to face the Philistines. Remember I told you on our map that Saul chose Gibeah because the road was narrow and everybody had to pass through there, so it was a key point. The Philistines took another key point called Michmash. Michmash was interesting because the road does an S-bend right there. It does a little S-bend, and it passes between two huge rocks in the middle of a gorge, just like Buttermilk Falls or Taconic Falls. You got to go up and you got to go down. On each side, though, instead of the layers of rock that we have, would be two huge, at that particular place, limestone, hard limestone pillars coming up that resemble teeth. That's what the word sena means. It's the Hebrew word for tooth. There's a Hebrew letter, sin or sheen. I don't know if you've ever seen it. And you look in Psalm 119. The next to last letter will be sin or sheen. Well, that's where the word tooth comes from, because their letter that was a sin or a sheen looked like a W, looked like a couple of jagged teeth hanging down. Somebody needed a dentist really bad, but they were filed down into two teeth. And what you've got here is two rocks sticking up on either side of a gorge that are so obvious that they've been given names. They're kind of like a geological feature that attracted people's attention. And it's a great place for the Philistines to put a garrison, because nobody but a fool is going to climb up there after them. Well, enter the fool. Jonathan said to his armor bearer, "Come, let us go over unto the garrison of these uncircumcised," that's the Philistines. "It may be that the Lord will work for us, for there's no restraint to the Lord to save by many or a few." One, we mentioned, there are people who really believe that God has equipped them. They really believe that God put them in that position at that time and gave them the ability and they should do the job. Two, there are people who believe that the power comes from God and not from themselves. Just because he had the weapons, he didn't run out and say, "Hey, look, my spear is bigger than your spear," you know, which, by the way, was a great advantage. Whoever had that longer spear, you know, about this much distance could mean a whole lot to you, because if his spear is this much longer than yours, that's about how deep it would pass through your body. And so you might say, "Hey, I got the big spear, I got the big shield, you know, or I got the big bodyguard." None of that. He said the point is, what difference does it make that God can save by many or a few? It's not my power. It has nothing to do with me. I'm just being used of God. He gave me the equipment, but he's the one who has to use me. You know, when you build a building, okay, when you put the additions on here, everybody gets together and you look over the plans and everybody plans what they want, and there's always some man in the church who's wise enough to look at the room and say, "You know, I want an outlet on every wall. I want an outlet." And any you men have done that. You put up a building, and when you're done, you put up a room. Why? Why? Well, because you want the easy access. I want an outlet on every wall. But I'll tell you, that's convenience. How many outlets do you need in a room if you want to have a TV set? Just one. Okay? If you get 30 outlets around the room, okay, you give a man a chance, and he'll put 30 outlets around the room. Just like a woman, you give her a chance and she'll put a million holes in the wall until she gets the picture where she wants it. The man figures, "Oh, that wall is mine. Don't put a hole in it. You know, you don't know what you're doing." The woman, no, she'll, until she gets the picture right, that's the important part. Besides, the picture is supposed to cover all the holes, you know. Unfortunately, by the time you're done, sometimes the picture ends up being about as high as your shoulders, you know. Got to cover up those holes. But you get a man a chance, and we had one deacon at Laurel who wanted to have 7 outlets in every room. Now, of course, our electrician was overjoyed to hear that news, but we had to say, "No, wait a second. This is a lot of money for all those outlets." The truth is, you only need one outlet. It doesn't matter how many outlets you have. The electricity coming into the room is what's important. And if you want to run a TV, if you want to run a blow dryer and blow dry your hair, it makes no difference whether you've got 20 outlets or one. You plug into one working outlet and you'll get the job done. Well, that's what we are. We're just outlets. And Jonathan recognized that. He says, what difference does it make if there's 20 outlets in the room or just one? If there's only one outlet, I can still work the material. I can still be used of God. And the people who do God's job aren't the people who think that they've got such great talents, and they're not the people who want to stick themselves out in front of people. They're the people who recognize and say, you know, it's all of God anyway, so what difference does it make? If it's one or 20, you know, it makes no difference to me. God can do it. Sometimes it's so disturbing that people don't get involved in the Lord's work because they don't think they have the gifts to do it. I'm really kind of glad that the whole gifts movement has kind of passed our movement by. Did you notice that? That it used to be that about 20 years ago, everybody was on a deep gift search. You know, what are my gifts and where are my gifts and what? And it kind of ran its course. And I'm kind of glad because there were some good things that grew out of that. But one of the bad things was everybody got out of a job because it wasn't their gift. Well, fortunately, evangelism's not my gift, so you're not going to see me on evangelism night, Pastor. And, you know, teaching's not my gift either. And helps? Nah, I know that's not my gift. My gift is criticism. You know, when you need it, I'll do it. I had a man in the church down in Laurel who said he had the gift. Maybe I told you this. He had the gift of discernment. Basically, what it was is one person in every church had it, but it was never the pastor. It was your gift to be able to discern when the pastor was doing something wrong. And he had that gift and like that. And I said, well, then there must be lots of other churches who need you to use that gift. And he said, well, yes, there are. And we reached a mutual agreement. I had gone over there to see him with the chairman of my deacon board, and he was just appalled. He says, in other words, what your gift is the ability to sit back and criticize everybody, but you don't want to teach with it, and you don't want to lead in a church with it. Yeah, right. Get out of here, you know. Hit the road, Jack. You know, I know a lot of Baptists got that gift, you know, and who seem to be filled with the Spirit whenever they need it. Well, gifts aren't important because God is the one who gives you the power. It's God who does it. When it comes to evangelism, who saves people? Who does the saving? Is it you? No, it's the Lord. It's the same outlet. I don't care where you are in the room. I don't care what's going on. You plug into the outlet, and it's the electricity that does the job. You can be a big, huge guy or a little guy. You're holding that hair blower in your hand, and the same work's going to get done. I don't care if you're the world's biggest genius, or I don't care if you're dumb as dirt. You turn on the hair blower, and your hair is going to get dry because the electricity's pushing the hair blower. Now, I've known some people who didn't seem to know how to flip it on properly. All right, that is a problem. But for most human beings, the power they recognize comes from God. And that's the people who get things done. Interesting, there's a lot of people, though, who have those first two steps. God's given me the equipment, and they say, yes, yes, I'm going to do it, and God can do it. And you know what happens? They get right to the edge, and they never get things done. There's always a reason why things don't get done. There's always some reason why, nah, I can't quite do that this week, or nah, this quite can't get done, or I'm just not sure we can take that step. By the way, it's a good thing we're not going into a building program when I'm preaching this. Sometimes churches, they worry about their pastor, you know, all of a sudden he's trying to build us up for some big works program, public works program, and I'm not contemplating that. But I just think that sometimes there's so many things to do that we find excuses not to do, even when we believe God can do it. Jonathan wouldn't buy that. This is what he tells his armor bearer. His armor bearer first says, everything that is in your heart, turn thee. Means whatever direction you want to go, you go there. Behold, I am with thee. I love it. He didn't say behind you. You know, I'm way behind you, guy. You know, just call for me and I'll be there. He said, I'm with you wherever you go. Then Jonathan said, behold, we will pass over unto these men and we will discover ourselves to them. If they say unto us, tarry until we come to you, then we will stand still in our place and we will not go up to them. In other words, we'll let them come and fight us. But if they say to us, come up unto us, then we will go up, for the Lord has delivered them into our hand. This shall be the sign. Now, you're the armor bearer. Okay, Jonathan is the guy with the bright ideas, and here's Jonathan's idea of how do I know that the Lord wants us to fight the Philistines? Here's what we'll do. We'll go discover ourselves to them. We'll stand over there and go, la, 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 la. You know, we'll discover ourselves. And then, if They say, we'll come over to you, then we'll fight them here. And if they say, you come over to us, we'll come over there and fight them. Now, his armor bearer is sitting there thinking, let me think this. Should we fight them or not? Is it the Lord's will? Let me see. We'll discover ourselves, and either they'll come over here and fight, or we'll go over there and fight. Guess what's not an option? Fighting. You mean we're going to, you want to vote? Let's talk about this plan. No, there's no choice. It's not a sense of it, should I do it or not. He knows that God's equipped him. He knows God has the power. He's going to do it. And it's not a choice of doing it or not. It's how do I do it? That's all he cares about. He's single-minded. Either I'll go over there or they'll come over here. We'll do it the easy way or we'll do it the hard way. Interesting what happened. Both of them discovered themselves under the garrison of the Philistines. That shows you what that armor bearer is all about. I mean, that really shows you. If it had been me, you're hiding down behind the rock, Okay, I'm three. We'll both pop up. One, two. Jonathan pops up. They see you, Jonathan. I'll just stay back here. I'll be your surprise weapon. Jonathan up there. They both discovered themselves. They're both standing there. I would have thought about that. We did that once. I had a friend. I'll tell you the story. We were in Scranton. And that's a wonderful place to be. And we were in this old house, and I had a friend. His name was Terry Zabolski. He was the former director of the pastoral studies at BBC. And another friend, and we were all good friends back then, until this incident at least, sitting in the living room talking one night, old house. All of a sudden, a bat comes flying in. Three grown men dove for cover. We're hiding under the couch. Terry's a big guy. He used to be a wrestler. Huge, big shoulders. While he was in college, he would do 500 sit-ups every night. He had an idea. He wanted to beat the Guinness Book of World Records for sit-ups. He was just a big guy. He was trying to fit under the TV stand. All things coming around. Get. So it flies into the kitchen. Okay? And so we close the door in the kitchen. We go in the other room. Then we start to feel guilty about it. It's like, oh, come on. We can't let a bat get the best of us. No, we're men. We be men. So we decided we had a plan. I tell you the truth. And Terry still remembers this plan. Here was our plan. We go down the hall. We stopped at the closet. One of us got a bat. One of us got a ski pole, and one of us got a glove. That was all they had in there, okay? They didn't even have two ski poles, right? So here was the idea that the one of us with the bat, we'd open the door, one with the bat would jump in, one with the glove would cover his head with the glove, run to the other door, open the other door, okay, because there's no light on the kitchen, so we need the door open, okay, and the one with the ski pole was going to push the door all the way open. So he pushes the door and holds it open. A bat guy comes in there to fight off the bat. And then the guy with the glove runs, covers his head, and opens the door. So we get in there. I am the guy with the ski pole. A fellow named Jack has the glove over his head. And Terry's the guy with the bat. Big guy, you hold the bat, Terry. So door opens up. Terry jumps in to defend him. Jack runs across to get the other door. We're all ready. Okay, I've got the thing on the door because I get a hold. It's one of those doors that'll swing unless you hold it. So I'm ready to push it open. The guy, Terry's going to jump in. Jack's standing behind him. In a moment of absolute, the Japanese call it Satori. It's a moment of absolute insight where everything is so plain to you in a second. We look over Terry's back at one another like, we thought of the same fiendish thing at the same perfect moment. The timing couldn't have been better. We just knew what we were going to do. So, the door opens. I push it open with a ski pole. Terry jumps in. Jack grabs the door, closes it, holds it, and yells, "Kill the bat!" Kill the bat. All of a sudden, there's a bat beating on the door. Ah, you run! And he's beating on the door, and we're holding it because he's a strong guy. All of a sudden, it stops, and we know he's recognized that he's alone in that room with the bat. Ah,
I mean, you're clang, clang, the table goes over the back, then he's beating his way to the door. He gets to the back door, and then, of course, we recognize he'd be coming for us sooner or later, so we ran out the front. All this by way of saying that there does come a time when you can't trust the people who are with you. You know, when it comes, you make all these great plans, like, I'm going to step out there for the enemy. I'm going to do something, and everybody stands up, and all of a sudden you look around, and it's like, all by myself again. You know, that can happen. And I'll tell you something, that the Lord's work prospers when the Lord's people can count on each other. Now, it doesn't say anything here that Jonathan couldn't have done it alone. But God didn't design for him to do it alone. He gave him the armor bearer. And what happens so often in the Lord's work is that the Lord's people find themselves alone in the room with the bat, you know? And it's a terrible feeling. And I've been there before. I've been where you're holding the bag and it's all yours. And I think that one of the things that stops people from moving out and getting things done is that absolute fear. That fear, by the way, that's what the armor bearer's job was. It was his job to protect the back of the soldier. He was a lad in training. And it was his job to protect the back of the guy in front of him. Okay? That's what he was supposed to do. When you were fighting, you were the one who took the lead and you're fighting with that iron weapon, and his job was to make sure nobody got in behind the guy, just the same way as two planes. One is lead and one's covering the backside. And I think that we miss a key point here, that here was somebody that Jonathan could count on. Here was somebody that God was blessing him with. Just one other thing here. Notice, the men of the garrison answered and said, come on over here in verse 12. Come up to us and we will show you a thing. You know, sounds like men. Come on up. I got something to show you up here. You know, oh, I don't know. It's about 38 inches long and made of iron. You know, you'll love it. Let me show you my new car. So they're all, come on up. And they're laughing to themselves. And notice, Jonathan climbed up on his hands and on his feet, his armor bearer after him. You got to climb down a mountainside in armor. You got to walk across the gorge, and you got to climb up the other side with that same armor. That armor, that's a whole lot of fun to have once you get up there. Can you imagine that? I wouldn't want to climb, period, with the enemy looking down at me. But how tired would you be when you got there? You're wearing iron. And he did all that. I'll tell you the truth, that God doesn't give the victory to people who aren't willing to put in some hard work first. The hard work comes first. You see that constantly in the scriptures, and it's not an accident. Lots of hard work. The going down, the climbing up. In fact, it was his plan. I'm willing to come over and fight you guys over there. Not meeting in between. I'm willing to come all the way to you. I think it's interesting, by the way, that this is a perfect parallel, and it's supposed to be, to the later story of David and Goliath. Because Saul, in the same situation, the Philistines on a hill on one side, him on the hill on the other in the valley, Saul wasn't willing to do anything. He got stuck in the same position. Let me just end with the armor bearer. He climbed up on his hands and his feet, and his armor bearer after him. I would really be praying that Jonathan was pretty nimble on his feet. How would you like to be climbing up, and there's a guy ahead of you? You know, you're looking up at the rump of a guy with 100 pounds of armor on his back, thinking, what if he goes? You know, what happens when he goes? What happens to me? You know, sometimes people get stuck in that situation. And they class themselves, and maybe God puts you in a role at some point as being a follower. You know, when you're in the role of a follower, that's a pretty uncomfortable role to be in. There's a guy up above you, he falls, and you're the one who gets squashed. You're the one who, without say nor nay in it, you're the one who gets stuck. And yet that armor bearer, it says, he stuck after him, and notice, and they fell before Jonathan, and his armor bearer slew after him. Jonathan knocked him down, and he went around and killed him. You know, that's an interesting job. Jonathan would fight and fight, and every time one of them would fall, he'd go over, you know, just running behind the big guy, you know, and Jonathan's doing the work. But why? Because if you don't have somebody behind you, one of those guys that you just knocked down and wounded, he gets up, and then it's big time trouble for you. hey, there's a job for everybody. I kind of like the armor bearer's job. You know, I'm in for that one. You know, but there's a job for everybody. It's just nobody gets around to it. And if it hadn't been for Jonathan and his sense of why God had put him there at that time and in that place and the urgency of the situation, this never would have gotten started. And I think that that's what the Lord's work needs. It needs Jonathans. We just happen to have a few too many Sauls running around to get the job done. Let's pray. Gracious Father, bless us tonight. Work in our hearts. I want to thank you and praise you for your word. It's warm tonight, Father, and it's so hard sometimes for us physically to concentrate. But may what we've learned tonight speak to us, for every one of us, Father, that you'd convict about what it is you have in front of us and the job that needs to be done. I pray that you would work deep in our hearts. I pray, Father, that you would make us people of the book, that every last bit of it works its way into our behavior. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.